Generosity is one of the virtues of Christian life that I admire the most. I love being around generous people. I love knowing generous people. I appreciate people who are generous with their time and invite you into their life and take time with you. I appreciate people who are generous with what they know and share that with you. I appreciate people that are generous with resources and who take those and put them into things that matter. It's something I aspire to. I want to be a generous person, and I love being around generous people. I think Jesus really knew what he was talking about when he said, it's more blessed to give than to receive. And when people with generous hearts get connected to a significant vision and put their resources into that, really powerful things happen, like an endowed chair at a seminary that's going to guarantee that for some generations to come, effective pastoral leadership is going to be taught at this place, and leaders are going to be shaped and formed. And so I'm grateful to the Rayburn family and to the anonymous donors who have put money into Truett Seminary, bringing their resources and generous hearts into connection with a vision for what that could be. And we're all grateful for that. We all benefit from that. I'm grateful for the generosity and confidence, however ill-placed, of this faculty and administration in naming me to be the inaugural holder of that chair. I am truly honored by that and deeply grateful, and will do my best to live into the confidence that you've expressed by that decision. I would also like to thank the generous friends who've made an effort to be here to share this time with us and with me today. I know the demands of their lives, and that carving out time to do something like this takes some effort and some generosity. And so Melinda and my pastors from UBC Waco, and Rick Carpenter from UBC Houston, Doug Tipps, longtime friend and a fellow pastor, Katie Long from across campus at the Wesley Center. I'm probably forgetting somebody here, but Jim and John, thank you for that and for kind and encouraging words. I really deeply appreciate it. I appreciate students being here who already have all their LLLs and had other options, but thank you for being here today. Chris, what are you going to do this weekend? Yeah, relax, okay. You think about what you're going to do after you graduate? Yeah. We have questions about the future like that, but they're usually kind of short-sighted. What are you going to do this weekend? What about after you graduate? We think a week ahead, a year ahead. But I want to ask you to stretch yourselves a little bit this morning. I want to ask you another question about the future. What are you going to be doing in 40 years? What about the year 2050? Where are you going to be? What are you going to be doing? What's the church going to be like? Hands down, my favorite movie of all times is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I've seen it a dozen times, once with Spanish subtitles. I'd watch it with you right now if somebody had it and you wanted to watch it. I love it. I laugh before the things happen because I know they're coming. But for the culturally illiterate, let me tell you a little bit about that. It is a film done by the Coen brothers, and it is based loosely, very, very loosely, on the story of Homer's Odyssey. And it's a story of Ulysses, Everett McGill, and Delmar O'Donnell, and Pete Hogwallop. They were chained together in a Mississippi prison chain gang, and Ulysses Everett, played by George Clooney, needs to escape. He needs to escape because his wife, Penelope, is going to marry one of her suitors, and he wants to get back there, his ex-wife, and stop her from that and remarry her. And so he's got to convince these two guys he's chained with to escape with him. And he does that by telling them that he pulled off an armored car heist some years ago, and he's buried the treasure from that in a valley that's soon to be flooded by a dam that's going to be built. And if they don't escape and get there and get the treasure, it's going to be lost forever. And he'll share it with them if they'll go. And so they agree to do that, and the three of them make their escape and get out of their chains and go along the way. But eventually, he's got to come clean with them and tell them about his deception. He comes to time where Everett turns to his two not-so-bright comrades, and he says to them, "Fact of the matter is, boys, there ain't no treasure. Fact of the matter, never was." And Pete is they both stare at him in disbelief, and Pete really can't believe. He stares off into the distance and just gets angrier by the second. He starts to say, "No treasure. I had 2 weeks left on my sentence. Now with the escape, I'm not going to get out of here till 1987. I'll be 84 years old. Now, Delmar, who never gets mad at anything, is over there doing the math in his head. And he goes, huh, I think they'll probably add 50 years on my sentence for that escape too. And Pete's 84 years old. And then Delmar finishes his math and brightens up and says, I'll only be 82. You start asking the question about what are you going to do in 2050? Where are you going to be in 40 years? You start doing the math and it becomes pretty clear that many of us on the faculty are not going to be around. Likely. Now, there are some of them here that are young enough to still be hanging around if you want to go find them. In 2050, you might find Dr. Arterberry and Dr. Brewer, Dr. Sands, maybe Dr. Tucker, Dr. Will High, Dr. Weaver. You might find them at the Dancing Bear nursing home. Maybe playing bingo and watching Baylor Bears play football, getting their 41st bowl bid of the century. Maybe you find Amy Jacober and Angela Reed, maybe sitting home in the rocking chairs, adjusting the reading glasses, reading a Baptist Standard article about your coming retirement celebration. Even Dr. Still might be hanging on, finalizing feebly that list of questions he wants to ask the Apostle Paul when he inevitably meets him. But there's a pretty good chance that many of us who are on the faculty will not be here. We will be on the other side doing whatever it is they let glorified seminary professors do. I imagine Dr. Gregory perhaps having conversation with Charles Spurgeon, swapping sermon illustrations. But every time Spurgeon starts to tell one, Gregory says, I've heard that one before. Perhaps I tried to picture Dr. Olson standing there with Jacob Arminius receiving apologies from Calvin and Piper. And I don't know how we could have been so wrong. And Dr. York perhaps suggesting a hymn or two for the four living creatures around the throne, saying, can we get something besides holy, holy, holy? Do you know worthy of worship? Dr. Glower taking daily silent strolls with St. Benedict. I don't know what we'll be doing, but I'm pretty sure that in 2050, many of us will be among the church triumphant, the communion of saints, the great cloud of witnesses watching you and cheering you on as you approach the finish line of the ministry that you've been called to do and that you'll be finishing up about that time. You will still be here, however, students, many of you. You will be part of the church militant still in 2050. But now the end of this ministry journey you've been on will be within sight. You will be thinking about retirement. You will be seeing it come to an end. You will be about to step out of the way, and you will be in the middle of the last church that you will serve in your ministry career, the church of 2050, the church two generations from now, the church your grandchildren will grow up knowing. That's where you'll be in 40 years. What will that church be like 40 years from now? If we could go back in time a little bit, I'm a little more familiar with that. Let's revisit 1990. 1990, I was about to turn 38. The era in history was about to turn 2000. And the coming of the turning of the century had lots of people's fears and imaginations running full speed. They were thinking about what it might be like. There were fundamentalists at that time doing the math, and their eschatological calculators were running full speed. And they were certain that in 2000, right around then, we would be seeing the end of all ages. I mean, after all, the world was created in 4000 BC. It had been 2000 years since Jesus was here. That's 6000 years. If the seventh day of the week of history, of 1000 years each, was going to be the millennium, then you do the math. Jesus is about to show up. There were others among us in Christendom who were thinking that Y2K might be the year that we complete world evangelization. There were New Agers about that time that saw this as a time of cosmic convergence and a whole golden age of the earth was about to dawn. In 1990, Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth, which was first issued when I was a freshman in college, went into its 108th printing. Zondervan had just re-released John Walford's book, Armageddon and the Mideast Crisis. They had re-released that. Prophecy and expectation and speculation about the future were just hot topics in 1990. In 1992, I attended a conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, sponsored by Leadership Network. Jim, you might have been there as well. It was called The Church in the 21st Century. Minneapolis was home to a Baptist pastor there, Leith Anderson, who had recently released a book with a similar title, A Church for the 21st Century. And so pastors and denominational leaders gathered in Minneapolis to think together about what will this church look like into the next century we're about to enter. Now, truthfully, most of the speculation about the future of the church at that time was about form. It was about externals. It was fairly superficial. Traditional or contemporary worship? Continued denominational relationships or dissolved denominational relationships? How user-friendly would the church be? Would it be megachurches in the 21st century or meta-churches with cell groups and house churches or programmatic churches? Or would the new fiber optic technology make it possible to have TV churches where people sat at home and were able to interact online? All those questions that focused around the issues of form and organization as the church entered this changed world of the 21st century were fairly superficial questions, it seemed like to me. Leith Anderson, in the book, A Church for the 21st Century, compared the church of the new century using a metaphor of the old DC-3 propeller-driven airliner and a Boeing 747. He said, the new century church will be an updated version of the old century church. It will differ in everything from cost to complexity, but both are the body of Christ and share the purpose of doing God's work in God's way, evangelizing non-Christians and edifying Christians. Apparently, Leith Anderson thought that it was just going to be an extension, that the future would look kind of like the present, kind of like the past, but just more costly, more complex, cooler. That's what the 21st century church would look like. And as the first 10 years of the new century are concerned, the spectators got some of it right and they got some of it wrong. Obviously, there were things they couldn't see, the wild cards of history. History's always stacked with wild cards in its deck. Who could have seen the growth of the World Wide Web and technological advances that were done by the mile, not by the inch or the centimeter? Spread of global terrorism, polarizing issues in culture, immigration issues, lots of wild cards in history that became part of 21st century experience. They couldn't have seen those, but that's the nature of the future. But when I look at the way they speculated about the church that would be coming, I think they missed it greatly. It was not, and is not already, is not simply an extension of the past. They failed to see the many new forms that have begun. They failed to see the new questions the church would begin asking for the first time. I have this stack of books in my office. Jim and I were talking about it a while ago because as Josie Bass authors, they send us new publication all the time. So this, I haven't read them yet. They just stack up. If you want one, come by. I'll see what I do for you. But that stack of books and their titles seem to me to be a kind of testimony to the work of a living church trying to adapt itself to a changing world. You just read the titles and you sort of get the idea. The seeker-sensitive church, the missional church, the purpose-driven church, the equipping church, the externally focused church, simple church, the third culture church, the multi-site church, the sticky church, the gathered and scattered church, church 3.0, the viral church, hybrid church, the whole church, church next. Those are titles which simply says we're struggling to figure out what it means to be the people of God in this changing world, and we're trying on lots of different things to see which kinds of things fit us best. Some of those efforts are experimental by nature and short-lived. Some of them may actually be sustainable for some time to come, but all of them are attempts of God's living church to do what it has been doing for 2,000 years, and that is to adapt itself to the culture and time, the ideological era in which it's been placed. The church has been doing that through persecution and during times with imperial blessings, through times of war and peace on six continents and every historical and ideological era the church has adapted and has survived. So what will the church of 2050 look like? Well, what will it have to adapt to? The technology that will be part of that world is something I'm in no position to talk about. We're thinking about a field now that knowledge is doubling every 1 to 2 to 5 years, depending on which specific field you're talking about. To guess about what the world will look like technologically in 40 years is pure speculation. So we just know it'll be a factor. But there's some things that we can talk about the future that are not so much speculation. They are trends. And they are trends that move like glaciers very inexorably forward and are not likely to be turned around quickly. Issues of demographics and ecology are some of the things the church of 2050 will be wrestling with. For example, the world that you and I live in right now is populated by about 7 billion people. Now, that's twice as many people that live on this planet as lived here when I received my MDiv degree. By 2050, there will be 9 billion, another third more. Some say 10 or 11 billion, but there are going to be a lot of people on the planet. In the United States, we have right now about 310 million people. That's going to swell by a third in the next 40 years to 420 million people, twice as many people living in this country as lived when I received my degree from seminary. The world that you face will be a world much more populous than the world that we're in now, which is much more populous than the world 30 years ago. Where are these people going to live, these 420 million Americans, these 9 billion people worldwide? They're going to live in very large, very crowded cities. In 1900, just 100 years ago, only 150 million people in the world lived in cities, period. By 2007, more than half, for the first time, more than half the world population was now living in cities. And by 2050, something like 70% of the world's population will live in cities. That's a trend that's not going to likely turn around. And these cities will be huge and populous. In 1900, there were 12 cities in the entire world with a million people in them. By 1950, there were 83 cities of a million people. Now there are over 400 cities of a million people. There are 18 mega cities in the world right now of over 10 million people, and those are going to continue to swell. If you're doing ministry in the year 2050, the odds are really, really good that you're going to be doing that in a large, urban, crowded, difficult setting. Really good odds, and there's all kinds of implications that go with that because we know what happens when people crowd into cities. We know the factors they're dealing with. We know about the crime and the disease and the poverty. We know about quality of life and issues of transportation. We know about waste management and energy demands, and these are only going to grow exponentially as our cities and the population grow exponentially. It's that world that the Church of 2050 will be adapting to. Property is likely to be scarce in cities growing quickly, and therefore it's going to be expensive, and models of church that are built around occupying a piece of property with large buildings are going to be increasingly more difficult to sustain. I suspect that it's only a matter of time before this increasingly secular culture we live in finally decides that these large pieces of church-owned property are no longer going to get a free ride on the tax rolls and may be exposed to local and state government taxes, and simply owning facilities in a time like that may be too burdensome for many congregations. And you add to that the environmental issues that are trending, and we know about them. What does this mean? Adequate clean water worldwide, not just in third world countries, is an increasing issue and will be more and more so as the cities grow. Food supply systems that we depend on without thinking, that are built on the need for cheap petroleum to move food from one part of the country to another, one part of the world to another, leaves cities incredibly vulnerable. If cheap petroleum fails and transportation fails, then how do you feed millions of people crowded into a city that can't raise food for themselves? Global climate change remains a wild card for coastal cities. With up to 70% of the world crowded into cities where their view of life is primarily asphalt, glass, and concrete, they're going to be increasingly alienated from creation and from each other. You who live and minister into the middle of the 21st century are recipients of the proverbial curse. May you live in interesting times, because you will. So what will the church look like in 2050? Well, let's visit our text. It's about time. The text this morning is Ephesians 4, 11 through 16, a future-oriented text. It's graced by no less than six teleological clauses that speak into God's purpose for his future. It's written in the eschatological language of promise. It's a statement of hope for every church and every culture and every age, every interesting time. And it describes the church of the future. The church of the future will be what it has always been. It will still be found in concrete expressions throughout the culture as an intentional, spirit-filled community of followers of Jesus Christ who are engaging the mission of God. And it will be marked by authentic relational unity that Paul describes here and a distinctive Christian maturity. invite you to study the text backwards. That's the best way to get at it. Start with the end, the description of the future church in verse 13. Until, that great eschatological word, looking forward, until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Then we will no longer be infants tossed back and forth by the waves, blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of men and their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will in all things grow up into him who is the head, that is Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each does its work. Nothing here about form, sorry. Nothing here about worship styles. Nothing here about physical buildings. Instead, the church of the future is described as the life of God's people in every future. Unity, rooted in the faithfulness and knowledge of the Son of God. Maturity, marked by stability in the truth, spoken in love, not tossed about by the gusts of false teaching that permeate every age. A body working together, supporting, growing, building itself up in love. That's the church of the future. That's the one God dreams of in every age. Now move backward in the text and see that behind that church, there stands a group of people. They're called pastoral leaders. It was he, the risen, ascended Christ, who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service so the body of Christ may be built up. Here these leaders, these pastoral leaders, are spoken of as gifts that the risen Christ, the ascended Christ, gives to his church. These apostolic, missional, evangelistic, pastoral teachers that he gives to the church to lead it, to do the things it needs to do in every future it faces. And I'm looking in the eyes of many of them right now. Gifts of God to his church. These leaders work at equipping the saints to engage the messianic ministry and mission in the world. These pastoral leaders are the key to the church of 2050. The church of the future will be led by men and women who have the capacity to pray and to think and to learn their way into the future. They will not be people who have a bag of tricks that they can apply. They will be people who can pray and learn and think. They are given to the church for that reason. That's why they are apostolic, evangelistic, prophetic, pastoral people. The church of the future will be led by men and women who are people of hope, who are responding to the promise of God and his vision for the future. They will be people who know God as the God of hope, the God of the future, the God whose essence is future, the God who is always coming to us, the God of Exodus, the God of the empty tomb, the God who stands in the future and speaks to his people and promises and beckons us to himself and says, it's okay to come where I am. Come on into this future. I'm here. There'll be people of hope. Read Moltmann. The church of the future will be led by people who know how to model unity and maturity. They've taken seriously words earlier in that text about bearing with one another and being humble and gentle and working hard to hold on to the bond of the Spirit, the bond of peace that's given by the Spirit. They are people who have been living this way for a long time and they've become masters of it. They know what it is to love God and to love people and to care little about personal success. The church of the future is going to be led by men and women who are passionate about the work of equipping the saints. They understand that the work of the church is the work of all the church, and they will constantly be helping people find how God has gifted them and engage them in the ministries to change the world, to bring the world in line with what God hopes it will be. That's what the church of the future looks like. I got to tell you, the church of the future was not really on the radar when I received my MDiv. It really wasn't. The faculty at the seminary where I graduated did not see it coming. I don't think they could. It was the time. It was where we were at the time. The future, in most people's minds, looked pretty much like an extension of the past. The curriculum 30 years ago that I went through was designed to prepare us to serve a rather stable, predictable future that looked very much like what had gone before. It prepared me well to serve the church of the 1950s and the 1960s. Problem was, they handed me my degree in 1976, and the world underneath my feet began to shake and crumble almost immediately. Within 10 years, my denomination was about to split. Technology was invading my world like nobody's business. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on a K-Pro 2 personal computer, a device that did not even exist the day I signed up for my first doctoral course. Churches began raising missional questions about how to serve and minister in their specific mission ministry fields, questions that people had very little interest in a generation earlier. Affordable air travel made it no longer enough to have missionaries with slide projectors. People wanted to get out of the pew and travel to these places themselves and get their hands dirty doing the work of missions. That changed. Churches began to specialize in ministry niches. Denominations struggled for connection with congregations, something they depended on earlier. Congregations worked on questions that the previous generation had ignored with absolute impunity. Questions about our vision, questions about our mission, our values. Curriculum suddenly was available from multiple sources, not just denominational publishing houses. Music and worship styles were changing. Technology invaded the worship space. I could go on and on. The world that I was sent into was assumed to be one way, a mere extension of the past, but it turned out to be another. And that was the world in which I spent the next 30 years attempting to be a pastoral leader. What was it in my training and education that made it possible for me to do so at all? I've thought about that a lot. I've thought about it often since coming here, especially since coming here, because I know that the world that students at Truett will face will be very different than the one I faced. What was I given in my training that allowed me to navigate those waters? Really quickly, I'm going to tell you first what proved least useful. That was every practical course in my curriculum. Those things, about the time I took my final exam, the stuff I'd learned was already obsolete. They were training to fight the previous war, not the one I was being deployed into. What proved most helpful? Students, you're not going to like the answer. Greek, Hebrew, biblical courses, theology courses, philosophy courses, history courses. Those were the things that were informing my thinking about moving forward into the future on the last day of my ministry as well as they did on the first. Now, right now, Amy Jacoburn, Angela Reed, and Terry York, and Hewitt Gloer, and Mike Stroop, and Joel Gregory, and I teach courses that are labeled practical theology, which is a term that didn't even exist when I was in seminary, I suspect. And they're called practical theology, not because what Roger Olson, Paul Sands, David Wilhite, and Brian Brewer teach is impractical theology, as we sometimes joke. Rather, it is to say that what you learn in text and traditions, what you learn in scriptures, is to be brought to bear on the ministry context in which you serve. And practical theology is bringing your thinking to bear on the practice of what you do. Your pastoral care, your spiritual formation, your education, discipleship ministries, your plans and programs, your mission strategies, all of those things are going to be informed by how you learn to think. Training in pastoral leadership is not the domain of one professor or one department on this faculty. The preparation of leaders for the Church of 2050 is what we all do together as a community. So what do I do with this information? Really quickly. 1995, Bill Gates published a book called The Road Ahead, in which he tried to think ahead about what's all this technology that we're engaging imply. He predicted some things, which are really fascinating to go back and read after the fact. For example, he predicted that we would have little boxes on top of our TVs that would allow us on demand to watch any show we wanted to watch. Imagine that. He also predicted something called the wallet PC. Have you ever seen a wallet PC? What he said was, right now you carry lots of things around in your pockets. You may carry a camera, you may carry money, you may carry an address book, you may carry your day timer, you get a long list of things you carry. But when this device comes out, man, you won't need all that. It'll be about the size of the wallet you carry in your pocket. You'll be able to do all kinds of things. Email, browse the internet, take notes, carry thousands of pictures. The irony of it is that Bill Gates' wallet PC is actually Steve Jobs' iPhone. But here's the point. Gates could see the future because, not because he was a prophet, he could see the future because he was up to his neck in it. It was in his head, it was in his heart, it's what he was doing. I can't see the Church of 2050. It's not in my head, it's not in my heart. It's in yours. And you will be the ones who build that church. It will become what you pray and learn and move forward to build. And regardless of the challenges that technology, demographics, ecology, or some other wild card throws in your path, you will be the people who will be equipped to do that because you've learned to think and learn and pray your way into that future. It's unrealistic to think that this seminary could train you to lead the church of the future in the way that, say, Hamburger University trains people to run McDonald's franchise. What we can do is equip you with tools that if you take them with you into ministry, hone their edges, keep them sharp, and master your skills with them will allow you to build the church of the future. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do. It's not a kind of passive learning where knowledgeable professors take empty-headed students and pour stuff into them, fix their ignorance. That's not the way it works around here. It's a learning community. It's a community of student scholars and faculty scholars. It's a place of respect and mutual love. It is a learning of community that extends beyond the receipt of a diploma into a future where we continue into conversations with each other and where future graduates are sent to you as well to continue their learning. It's not something that's over when you become an alumnus. It is a continuing relationship of learning. And we've come to believe that it's worth our lives in ministry to invest in that process because the future matters for eternity. Now may the God of hope fill you with joy and peace in the Spirit as you trust in Him. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and will be forever. Amen.